ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It is Monday, the 12th of February. I'm Sally Sara, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, a former spy boss says contracts for Australia's offshore processing program were awarded to companies suspected of arms and drug smuggling. And shutting down the Shonks, an NDIS task force aimed at flushing out dodgy providers, starts today. But some in the disability community are worried.
We're really concerned that we'll be forced into using very restrictive and rigid, you know, ways of being supported. And that's not going to be good for anyone, especially not the cost of the NDIS.
First today, a new report warns that outdated teaching methods are creating a crisis in literacy, with one in three Australian students unable to read properly. The Grattan Institute has described it as a preventable tragedy. It says children who fall behind are unlikely to catch up, placing them at higher risk of being unemployed or even jailed later in life. Experts say there's a clear and widely accepted solution to the problem, but it's not being implemented rapidly enough. Gavin Coote reports.
Australia has a reading problem, with the Grattan Institute finding a third of the nation's children are struggling with reading. And experts like Professor Pamela Snow argue it's the way reading is taught that's to blame.
There may well be multiple ways to teach children how to read, but some are clearly more effective than others, and that's what this report is highlighting.
The report has found in the typical Australian classroom of 24 students, 8 can't read well, and they're more likely to fall behind their classmates, become disruptive, and drop out of school. It attributes this to the rise of a teaching style called whole language, which became popular in the 1970s and is based on the idea that learning to read is an easy and natural process. The report points out this is leaving students trying to guess the meaning of words. Professor Snow from La Trobe University's Science of Language and Reading Lab agrees.
Reading and writing are not natural things for children to do, for humans to do. We have to be taught how to do these things. We've got a language brain, we don't have a reading brain.
Many experts want a greater focus on what's known as a structured literacy approach, right through school, which includes an emphasis on phonics in the early years. Dr. Jennifer Buckingham is the Director of Strategy with Multilit, which runs evidence-based programs for reading instruction and interventions.
There's plenty of evidence to show that just reading to children with children isn't enough to get them reading themselves. It's a wonderful thing to do. It certainly helps. It builds their confidence with books and their familiarity, their oral language. But in terms of that actual mechanism of understanding the relationship between the letters that they see on the page, or, you know, what are initially, they don't even know are letters, they're just little sort of black squiggles, and how they represent the sounds that they hear in spoken language, and then how to, you know, build those relationships and be able to use, you know, what is phonics. So phonics is the relationship between the sounds of speech and the letters and the letter combinations we use in the written words. Once children understand that, then they can use that knowledge to decode any word. But that is not something that they can just pick up on their own. They need to be taught that in an explicit and systematic way.
Are there parts of the country or particular schooling systems where this is being done effectively?
A growing number of systems and individual schools are starting to use this systematic and explicit approach. And we can actually see that in Year 3 NAPLAN. It's probably the only trend line that is gradually moving up, but it's not moving up quickly enough. And that's because not enough systems and schools are adopting this approach.
One schooling system that's getting results is the Catholic Education Archdiocese of Canberra and Goulburn. Its emphasis on direct instruction is being hailed by policy experts like Jessica Del Rio from Equity Economics, who's been studying literacy standards across the country.
So we did look at the outcomes for students in Catholic schools in Canberra, and we were able to see that since they introduced their change through the Catalyst program, they've significantly lifted the performance of their schools. So in 2019, 42% of Catholic schools were underperforming in reading in Canberra, and 4 years later, they'd got that down to 4% of schools, which is a really significant reduction and an improvement in reading for Catholic schools.
In a statement, Federal Education Minister Jason Clare said the science on teaching reading has been settled and has flagged future school funding will be tied to evidence-based teaching methods.
That's Gavin Coote there. The former head of Australia's spy agency has found companies linked to suspected corruption, bribery and drug smuggling were handed massive government contracts to run the offshore processing of asylum seekers. Dennis Richardson's report has found the Home Affairs Department, run by then-Minister Peter Dutton, used shortcuts during contracting. It led to hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayer funds going to companies now accused of criminal wrongdoing. Angus Randall reports.
Two companies under investigation by federal police. One company director suspected of breaking Iran's sanctions and a CEO suspected of gun and drug smuggling. It's a worrying account of companies handed hundreds of millions of dollars by previous governments to run Australia's offshore processing. Former ASIO Director General Dennis Richardson has been investigating on behalf of the current government.
Where you are entering into contracts in high-risk environments with small companies, you obviously need to do a little bit more research and you obviously need to exercise a bit more curiosity.
Offshore processing of asylum seekers was reactivated by the Labor-Gillard government in 2012. Dennis Richardson found contracts were put together quickly, and while some were reassessed by subsequent governments, others were left as they were. He looked into department contracts from 2017 onwards, when the Home Affairs portfolio was led by now opposition leader Peter Dutton. Mr. Richardson found the department failed to vet companies to ensure they were worthy of these multi-million dollar contracts.
It was a breakdown in communication, one, within the Department of Home Affairs, particularly between its procurement area in the intelligence division, and secondly, a breakdown in communication between the Department of Home Affairs and other agencies, especially AUSTRAC.
One of these companies, Paladin, was paid more than $500 million over 4 years to run offshore processing on Manus Island. Paladin is now facing federal police investigation over allegations of paying $33 million in bribes to Papua New Guinea officials. Despite this, Dennis Richardson says these companies might still have won these contracts.
There are certainly limited choices, and I made it very clear in my report that it is possible that even if the Department of Home Affairs had have accessed the information that was available, they may still have been required to give the contracts to the companies that indeed got them. However, if they had have accessed the right information, they could have put in place mitigating measures and they could have reduce the risk.
Current Home Affairs Minister Claire O'Neill says the buck stops with then Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton.
What really makes me angry about this is the hypocrisy at the heart of all of it. We've got Peter Dutton presenting as an absolute fraud here, someone who pretends to be a tough guy on the beat, but in fact was presiding over a system that was funneling hundreds of millions of dollars potentially into things like drug running and human trafficking. Now, he has to come forward today and tell us why he seems to have not asked a single question about this in the entire time that he was minister.
In a statement, a spokesperson for Peter Dutton said the then minister was not involved in the regional processing contract or procurement decisions and did not discuss such decisions with the Secretary of Home Affairs. Senate Estimates has spent the morning discussing the report. Department of Home Affairs Secretary Stephanie Foster told the Legal and Constitutional Affairs Legislation Committee the current contracts look very different.
I think there are significant shortcomings and I think that they've been addressed and they will continue to be addressed by the processes that we've put in place to ensure that that due diligence and that sharing of information is actually dealt with.
The Greens have asked for a royal commission into the issue, but the government says the Richardson report is comprehensive.
That's Angus Randall reporting. You are listening to The World Today. NATO has reacted angrily to suggestions by former US President Donald Trump that he would encourage Russia to attack any NATO country which doesn't spend enough on defence. NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg says the comments could put EU and US lives at risk. The White House has described Mr. Trump's remarks as appalling and unhinged. So what does the prospect of a second Trump presidency mean for US allies, including Australia? Michael Shoebridge is founder and director of Strategic Analysis Australia.
He has a fundamental disregard for alliances and partnerships. He thinks that they're just entanglements for America and they're business costs. So he fundamentally doesn't value them. And then the second thing is his continuing high regard for the world's autocrats. He seems to almost envy them and see them as friends and people he can do deals with.
Are these dangerous comments for NATO?
They're very dangerous because an alliance like NATO is a long-term arrangement that sets the conditions of the world's security. But Donald Trump doesn't seem to see that.
We've seen angry reaction from NATO. How concerning is this if Donald Trump goes on to become the Republican candidate and perhaps goes on to win the US presidential election?
I think it's extremely concerning. We'll hear a whole lot of apologists tell us he doesn't mean it, it doesn't mean what he says, that this is just Trump's way of getting America's allies to step up and pay their way. I think that's an unfortunate, complacent mischaracterization of what we're seeing.
Given what's happening in Ukraine at the moment, how much tension is there already on NATO's frontiers, particularly with the Baltic states? We know we have so-called tripwire troops there, that if Russia were to come across the border, troops from other nations will already be on standby and ready to swing into action.
Well, the Europeans have been really taking the broader threat of Russian aggression seriously because they know that Putin is an opportunistic, aggressive figure. And so they're already seeing a heightened risk around Russia broadening the conflict from the war in Ukraine. And any uncertainty or, in fact, weakness in NATO injected by Donald Trump will just be seen as making Putin more likely to take advantage and be aggressive and opportunistic. So it's a dangerous time already, and the US election is not till November.
What would a Trump victory mean for us here in Australia at a time when defence contracts are blown out and behind schedule? We haven't recruited enough people to be in the ADF, and under Trump we would have a president again who doesn't favour alliances and has also been opposed to things like AUKUS.
Well, Donald Trump doesn't know the decision he would take on any issue before he takes it. That makes him an inherently unreliable alliance partner. What does Australia do with that in prospect? We need to make our security less dependent on the whims of whoever is in the White House. So that means a whole lot of partnerships and relationships with Congress, with the State Department, with the Pentagon, with American industry. But we can't just work around whoever's in the White House. So this would be a damaging thing for Australia because of the uncertainty and unpredictability. But it means we've got to do more for our own defence. And it means we're working more closely with partners we can rely on, like Japan and South Korea.
That's Michael Shoebridge there, founder and director of Strategic Analysis Australia. After days of delay, protests and rumours of cheating, Pakistan's election result has been announced. The party of former cricketing superstar and former Prime Minister Imran Khan has won. It clinched victory despite Mr. Khan being imprisoned and the party's candidates being forced to run as independents. But Mr. Khan's main political rival, Nawaz Sharif, claims to have won the poll, setting the stage for upheaval. Nicole Johnston has the latest.
Pakistan's election is over, but its political turmoil is anything but. Protesters turned out over the weekend, demonstrating against alleged voter rigging. The result, announced Sunday, saw the party of jailed former Prime Minister Imran Khan win the election, even while Mr. Khan sat in a prison cell. The result has stunned the nation. Khan's party, called Tehreek Insaf, or PTI, did not have the powerful military establishment's support, and it still won. Zulfi Bakhari is Imran Khan's international media advisor and a former cabinet member.
Well, a lot of people have taken to the streets across the country, particularly outside administrative offices. Especially those who are, you know, absolutely adamant that their mandate has been stolen from them.
How has it been able to do this with Imran Khan in jail, your election symbol banned, and the crackdown on PTI?
This wasn't that surprising in the sense that we knew that this was brewing and there was a ground swelling. And people have, you know, bared a lot in the past 18 to 24 months of a lot of cruelty and a lot of oppression. And we knew that the revenge of all of that was going to be via the ballot and the vote.
The problem is Nawaz Sharif, who is also a former prime minister, has also claimed victory and is urging other parties to join him in a coalition government. He insists he can rescue the country from chaos. In Pakistan, political dynasties run deep. The third major party is led by Bilawal Bhutto Zardari, the son of assassinated Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. With no party winning an outright majority, Pakistan's political jockeying begins. Tira Abdullah is an election observer in Islamabad and a human rights defender. She says the country is bracing for prolonged instability.
You'll see more shock than the Pakistani public, if I may inject a little bit of on a lighter note. Those of us who are observers noted that by and large, polling was fair and square from 8 o'clock in the morning up till 5 o'clock in the evening when they closed. I did not observe any kind of hanky-panky or rigging or wrongdoing happening.
But there are reports of voting irregularities in other parts of Pakistan, though.
Of course, we were watching on our television screens. They showed irregularities. They showed ballot boxes being stolen, being stuffed, polling agents not being allowed.
How unstable is Pakistan now?
May I answer very, very seriously that we are as unstable today as we were on the 7th of February prior to elections 2024. It is an unstable country, period, full stop.
That's Pakistan election observer Tara Abdullah speaking with Nicole Johnston. Back home now, and Queensland's Police Commissioner is set to address State Cabinet today amidst heightened concern over youth crime. The alleged fatal stabbing of grandmother Vylene White is the latest in a spate of high-profile crimes fuelling the ongoing law and order debate. It's a key election issue this year, with the state's opposition saying the government is not doing enough to tackle youth justice, while some advocates argue it's already gone too far. Annie Guest reports.
From Queensland's southeast to northwest, the state's LNP opposition argues youth crime is out of control. Its justice spokesman is Dan Purdy.
Crimes across all crime classes across the state have increased substantially.
In this state election year, law and order is a hot-button issue, with young Queenslanders linked to a string of alleged high-profile crimes in recent years, ranging from the fatal stabbing of a grandmother last week, another earlier stabbing of a woman during a home invasion, and the killing of a couple and their unborn child by a teenager in a stolen car. In Townsville, there have been frequent complaints of car theft and home invasion.
I was only in North Queensland last week, including Mount Isa on Friday, and since 2015, unlawful use of a motor vehicle, as in stolen vehicles, has increased by about 200% in those areas.
But the Minister for Youth Justice, Di Farmer, has a different take.
Overall, the number of young people committing offences has decreased. So over the last 15 years, there's actually been a 45% decrease. But what we are seeing is that a small cohort of young people, really serious repeat offenders, they're committing more than 50% of the crime. So the numbers of offences they are committing has increased.
The government has introduced a range of measures aimed at tackling youth crime. Last year, it overrode the state's Human Rights Act to make breach of bail an offence for children and expanded trials of electronic monitoring or GPS trackers. It's also rolled out a trial of wanding, where police can use handheld metal detectors to check for weapons like knives, axes and machetes. And expanding wanding may be something the Police Commissioner calls for when she addresses State Cabinet today.
I can't preempt what the Police Commissioner will say to us. I think she's flagged electronic monitoring devices and the knife laws and this group of young people, the way they're operating is evolving. The police have the intel. If something is not working, we need to stop doing it. If it is working, we need to do more of it. So we really value what the police commissioner and the police are saying to us.
Queensland already spends more on youth justice than any other state or territory and has more children in detention. Youth advocates have consistently argued the current measures are draconian and misdirected, filling watch houses and failing to help troubled young people, many of whom have suffered abuse or neglect. Catherine Hayes is the CEO of the Youth Advocacy Centre, and she says organisations within the sector have been calling for better intervention for years.
They're cycling in and out of the detention centres. Until we provide them with proper rehabilitation and early intervention, we're going to see increasing youth crime.
But one policing measure has her support.
The extension of the wanding trial is a good idea, and it will probably help dissuade people generally and young people from carrying weapons, and we support that. The GPS trackers are more problematic because there are very few young people who are serious repeat offenders who are eligible to use them.
That report from Annie Guest and Liz Cramsey. The National Disability Insurance Scheme is set for a large overhaul of its provider registration system, which the minister says will ensure better outcomes for participants. A task force has been set up to design a new registration system. Bill Shorten says it will improve quality and safety, but some advocates warn it will be a challenging balancing act. Alison Shaw reports.
Samantha Connor says she's always valued trust and flexibility when reaching out for support.
I've never used a registered provider of supports, primarily because I wasn't able to get them. You know, so in regional Australia, there's very often long waiting lists and you just don't know the experience that you're going to get.
A wheelchair user who spent many years in the Western Australian Wheatbelt region, she fears new changes to the National Disability Insurance Scheme will do more harm than good.
We're really concerned that we'll be forced into using very restrictive and rigid, ways of being supported. And that's not going to be good for anyone, especially not the cost of the NDIS. The concerns are around things like thin markets, that there might not be enough people in regional and remote areas, that it will limit choice and control, and that people won't get the support that they need.
As of last year, out of more than 170,000 providers, just 16,000 were registered with the NDIS.
The status quo is not working. We know that some of the cost drivers are poor outcomes driven by some service providers who are more interested in their bottom line than they are the people they're working with.
NDIS Minister Bill Shorten says the current system for registration isn't working.
Quite simply, in the last 10 years, there's been two systems in the NDIS, one for registered providers and then unregistered providers. It's simply not fit for purpose.
The government's setting up a task force today to look at how the registration system would work. It'll also co-design the scheme with the disability community. Mandatory registration was one of the recommendations to come out of last year's review of the NDIS.
So what we want to do is make sure that we've got a system where we know what's going on, where we've got a clear line of sight on all people delivering services.
Disability activists say many in the community are nervously awaiting further detail.
It's a really, really big piece of work that everybody is a bit anxious over.
Nicole Lee is the former president of People with Disability Australia.
When it comes to the registered provider piece, of course, there's a lot of anxiety with the community on how that's going to look like. What role does that have in regards to our choice and control around people who are self-managed, participants that manage their own funds? How far does the registration of providers sort of stretch? Does it go into consumables or is it just for, face-to-face service provision? There's lots of details we kind of really need to see and have oversight on.
She says the task force will have a difficult balancing act ahead.
We also need to ensure that whatever this is moving forward, we need to have that balance of being able to have choice and control, making sure whatever systems are being put in place are not not arduous for individuals to get registration,
and ensuring that we're retaining the people that are working well for us, and closing the door on people that are just out to exploit us.
The task force is due to report back by the middle of the year. The government will consider its recommendations before making further changes.
That's Alison Shaw, and that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Sally Sara. Take care.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. What happens when Vladimir Putin is interviewed by a conservative American media commentator at the height of a war and it lasts for more than 2 hours? Well, the answer is Putin wins. So what was the real reason behind Tucker Carlson's interview with the Russian leader? And how does it play into Donald Trump's push for the White House? Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.